Okay, thank you. Those who came, I'm happy to be here still. Thank you for coming. For class number two, for the next 10 weeks, we're going to try to enter into another world, a world that most of us are not familiar with, a world that some of us are not comfortable with whatsoever. We're going to try to enter into the world of a non-Jew and try to understand his perspective on us, on Jews and Judaism. We want to not simply critically evaluate the works that he has written, but rather we want to try to enter into his mind, his perceptions, his thoughts, his feelings, and try to understand how he understands us. Too often, we do the opposite. What we do too often is that we remain on the outside and we react to what he says about us. As Jews, we react to this about our religion, Judaism. Here we're trying to enter into his world and figure out, why does he feel the way he feels about us? In some cases, it's going to be relatively odd. In some cases, we may be more difficult to figure this out. Now, you may question, what's the point of doing this? What's the point of entering into this non-Jewish world, non-Jewish literary world, to figure out what he thinks about us and why he does that? If I'm not mistaken, Ricky, you could correct me on this. This is the first time in the Syrian community in its 100-year history that anybody has ever attempted to do this. Is that correct? Now that's a bad comment, either on me or on the Syrian community. One or the other. Nobody ever before has thought about trying to enter into the non-Jewish mind and heart and soul to figure out what his perceptions are of Jews and Judaism. No one ever spoke about this topic before. Analyzing, thinking about five non-Jewish authors and what they have to say about Jews and Judaism. You may think that the reason nobody's ever done this before is because it's a trivial topic. Who really cares? Alan?
How many rabbis, five rabbis actually?
I didn't want to say that. And I don't say it, so I didn't say that. Alan, that's not me. That's another question. Now, what I'm going to argue this evening, that this is not only a significant topic, it's a topic which is of absolute significance, without any degree of hyperbole or exaggeration, that is perhaps one of the most important classes or discussions that we could actually have, of absolute significance. It's extraordinarily important that we deal with this particular topic and this issue. I'm going to try to defend that statement from three distinct vantage points. Right? First of all, on the purely pragmatic grounds, we are living in a Christian country. There are 280 million Americans in this country. There are 5.3 million Jews. Approximately 100,000, 200,000 Muslims, right? Give or take, they give different numbers. That's what the number is usually given. They say more, we say less, whatever it may be. And these 280 million Americans, minus the 5.3 million Jews, their opinions about us are shaped by what popular writers write about us. We are not going to be reading any academicians. We're not going to be reading about any philosophers' thoughts about Jews and Judaism. We could. And maybe we'll make reference to them. That's not my primary goal. My primary goal is to read about those non-Jewish authors who shape the opinions of millions and millions and millions of people, what they say about us. Now, if we were to take, for example, Alan's book, The Source by James Michener, which was first published around 1965. He's reading it now. This is amazing. And he's listening to his tapes, 48 tapes. We've got a lot of work to do. But they're going to have to catch a few anyway, so. Think about this book. It was published first in 1965 or 66, right? It went through, I think it's 10 or 15 editions of the book. I meant to get more of these sticks on it, but I wasn't have a chance to do that. Has a staying power of more than 40 years because it's recently also been again reissued. So it has a staying power of 40 years. It has sold 10 or 15 or 20 million copies, if not more. And that book is shaping the ideas about us among millions and millions of Americans. Now, of course, you may wonder, why did James Michener, who is a Southern Baptist down south, why did he care enough to spend 8 years, he says, or 10 years, researching a book about Jews and Judaism? Why did he spend all that time doing so? It's a good question I'm going to try to deal with. But on purely pragmatic grounds, should we not be concerned about this book, which is now shaping the opinions of millions of Americans, to one degree or another? To one degree or another. Not everybody who reads the book is going to be influenced one way or another. But still, know a book that has been around for 40 or 45 years and that has sold millions upon millions of copies, you should want to know what he is saying about you, about Jews, and about Judaism. These opinions obviously could translate into political, legislative issues regarding Israel or regarding us. What the non-Jew thinks of your neighbor or your business associate should matter to you, because that could affect, again, either Israel, which is of great significance to us, or could affect us in various forms of legislation, or regarding any kind of projects that we may have, whatever it may be. You want to know who is shaping the opinions of those who decide these issues on a popular level. So James Michener happens to have this great gift of writing popular books, and it happens to be, he wrote a book about Jews and Judaism. Now, it's interesting because right now, Joe Lieberman is running for office, the office, and what he does is that he wears his Judaism on his sleeve, very proudly and prominently. So now a lot of non-Jews out there are going to vote for him based on this issue. Not everybody, of course. But many of them are saying, do I want to have a Jew in the presidency? And they may have read the source by Michener. They may say, wow, that's really something great. The Jews do carry something really wonderful. And therefore it's good to have a Jew in the office. 2 days ago, I was reading the Federation County newspaper of New Jersey. There's a person there, his name is Donald Christentum, who's non-Jewish. He writes a whole article on why Israel is getting shafted by this government and by anti-Semitism. Now that has a lot more impact than if I wrote the same exact article, which is obvious. He's a Christian, I'm a Christian, and I want everybody to know about anti-Semitism. He's not an academician. I think he's a plumber or something. I don't know what he is. But he just feels that Israel is getting shafted by this country and about Saddam Hussein. Nobody sees the evil involved. People are going to read that. Whoever it's going to be is going to read that and say, wow, here's a person who's not Jewish, who has these feelings. What does it really mean? So what non-Jews say about us is of great significance, and perhaps more significant than what we say about ourselves.
It makes it credible.
It makes it credible, exactly. So Joe Lieberman, who is very Jewish, is going to either gather more votes or less votes, depending upon what the popular perception of the Jew is. Yeah, David.
I take issue with that statement, that it makes it credible. You're talking about when they support us. What about when they criticize
both.
Us?
Both. It might be both. Okay. Depends. No, not necessarily. It's what I'm trying to get into that mind of the average Joe on the street, who does, in fact, vote, let's say. Right.
But one of the reasons to read it, I'm sure you're going to say this.
What's the it? Michener you're talking about?
To read non-Jewish writers.
Oh, okay.
Right. It's also to verify what they're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, I'm going to get into this. Right. Absolutely correct. but on purely pragmatic grounds, what they're writing on a popular level. It's such a fascinating feature of democracy that the person with a PhD and is brilliant has only one vote, the same as my plumber friend. It's astounding. The Adlai Stevensons, who were brilliant, lost the presidential elections because they were too brilliant. Isn't that astounding to you? It's amazing. The way democracy works. The plumber, who is illiterate, untutored, never read a book about political science in his whole life, doesn't know anything about political science, he's pulling that lever, and the guy who comes after him is pulling the lever also, who knows everything about politics, everything about everything. Same vote. So it's what popular writers are writing, in our case about us, is of great significance to us. We should want to know, to verify, etc., on purely pragmatic grounds. So, good. Interesting, if someone were to write an anti-Semitic book about us that sold millions and millions of copies, what would you say? We should be aware of it. Because we want to refute it, we want to argue with it, we want to challenge it. But imagine if somebody were to be able to stir the American pot. If you were a great writer and knows how to use words really well, and he's almost a kind of a quasi-charlatan. So that particular person has to be challenged. If he's not challenged, we pay the price. Now, something very similar to this happened recently. In which context? Not exactly, but in which context something happened? An author? No, you're going back too far. An author?
One from Italy who was selling a million copies in France.
That's the girl.
The young girl.
The young girl.
The young girl.
The French girl about the
people. No. I'm talking about John Irving writing books about the Holocaust and denying that it really ever happened. So imagine this evil. That here's a person who is a great author, quasi-historian, is now challenged whether or not the Holocaust really happened.
What book is that?
Oh, it's a series of his books. And who is he challenged by? Debbie? Yeah, in England. Debbie Lipstadt, who's a Holocaust historian. She challenged her, and he took her to court.
He sued her,
he took her to court. And she had to win. And what everybody was saying is that what had to be proven over here? It's not an issue between he and she. The issue is, did the Holocaust really happen in the way that we tell the story? Did 6 million Jews happen? Were there really gas chambers? Really crematoria or not? He said, not really.
Are you talking about John Irving, the novelist?
No, not John. I'm sorry. No, it's Irving.
Irving something.
Oh, I'm sorry. Something. No, somebody else. Yeah. But over here, what's significant is that that trial translates into Arab propaganda, Protocols of Zion, all over the place. And if it's not challenged properly, that she did, and it cost millions of dollars that her publisher paid for, we could have suffered a great loss for that. And of course, she won the case. She had proved that what really happened. And then he intentionally falsified the records and his books and his documents and all that stuff. Not easy to do. But she was able to do it because she had the information, she knew it, she read it, because this man had an audience, an impactful audience. So therefore, one on pragmatic grounds wants to know what somebody's writing about us, whether it's anti-Semitic or whether it's positive. First reason. Now, the second reason why we should be aware of what non-Jews are writing about us is probably related to the most fundamental principle of all of Judaism, which is something we spoke about this last hour before. What is our overriding concern as Jews?
Survival.
Survival, yeah, but that's not from the very beginning, that's now. To see how we... Right, very good. To see how we have impacted upon the rest of the world. Leken olam b'machut shadar. Right, that's what we want to do. It's interesting that that phrase, to establish the world under the sovereignty of God, of Hashem, right? The rabbis took that phrase and put it in Alina Shabbat, which means the last idea that you pray, three times a day. What are they in effect saying? That when you finish praying, go out to the world with that notion. That can olam b'chuchadai, tikkun olam, change and amend and impact and improve the world. Right? The rabbis want us to be aware of that. So we as Jews are not simply a self-contained entity, but rather, what are we really all about? Impacting, as we mentioned, the first class. Now, if so, then we as Jews and we as a nation should be focused on this goal, right? And in the first class, we gave a detailed presentation as to what and how that all, how that has happened. When we read non-Jewish authors about us, we are taking note as to whether or not we are succeeding. What is his impression about us? Meaning, it doesn't matter so much what we are really thinking and doing if we're not getting our message across. So we could be the most pious and the most wonderful and the most just and the most honest people. But if the non-Jew's perception of me is that I lack integrity and I'm not honest, then I've lost. I've not accomplished that which I want to accomplish.
But they might have an agenda.
Correct. So we want to evaluate it.
Okay, but the agenda can be based on something that wasn't really significant. Otherwise, what if someone cut them off on the highway that they were in Yarmulke?
Correct. So I want, if he writes a very, if I know that, I want to write about that.
Isn't that a problem?
It's absolutely a problem.
Yeah.
His scenario is a problem.
Agreed.
The guy with Yarmulke cutting you off on the highway is a problem.
Yeah. So therefore, take the Yarmulke off.
Right.
I didn't say that, did I? No, therefore, don't cut him off on the highway. Don't cut him off. You know, so, exactly right. So you want to know his agenda. But my point of it is, you want to... You want to evaluate. You want to know, what is he writing? Am I impacting properly upon that non-Jewish person? Am I doing it or not doing it? If my goal is to impact upon the non-Jewish world, which it is really on one level of our existence, then am I doing it? Am I not doing it? Or am I not doing anything? Let's assume that for 100 years, nobody writes any books or articles or even one word about Jews and Judaism. Is that bad or is that good? Why is that terrible?
Nobody's paying attention.
Right.
No impact.
No impact.
No impact.
Yeah, we did nothing.
And no interest.
And no interest. So that means we're not accomplishing what we want to accomplish. So now, if it's negative, we have to challenge it and question it and figure out what's his agenda. If it's positive, and then maybe we're getting on that source. Now, what if on the other side of the coin, let's say for 50 years, people wrote every year a wonderful book about Jews and Judaism. But she has on the way. Yeah, that can't happen.
Nobody bought it.
So we want to figure that out. Maybe we are doing something that's right. And by contrast, if for 50 years, every year somebody writes a negative book about us, then we're not going to say that every single time that negative book comes out, somebody cut him off because he's wearing a yarmulke. But maybe we do something wrong. And right now, of course, this question is all the more significant because Israel is such a high-profile country. Israel is out there in the news. Front page of the New York Times, and it was a study done, you know, why is Israel so much in the New York Times when it's so much a small percentage of the world's population and the world's interest and all that stuff, yet it's there. I think it was 20% of the time, whatever this is. So we're out there. Somebody's watching what we do. And they're questioning. And therefore, if we don't do what's right, it's going to have, especially in the age of instant communication and with explosive knowledge, everyone's going to know what Israel does. Very serious issue. Yeah.
To what degree does ingrained anti-Semitism affect or counteract
to a great degree.
Actions or our impact? In other words,
to a great
negate
degree.
Our actions.
To a great degree, you're right. There is absolutely ingrained anti-Semitism out there, so maybe we have to work harder to change that person's opinion, if we could do so. And we want to work towards doing that, however we could do it. Personally, collectively, as a nation, we want to do what we can do in order to change that person's negative stereotype of the Jew.
Is that our goal, or is our goal just to impact the goyim with the
values? They go hand in hand, really. They really go hand in hand. Because if that person is writing negative stuff about us...
Yeah, we lose the validity.
Right, absolutely. And this is all the more true than a college campus, where everybody writes ideas, right? Now, you can define your anti-Semitism on a college campus, and you're non-Jews who don't really know one way or the other. Now, again, one of the issues are... divestiture from, you know, Columbus issues, Harvard issues, all these issues. taking money away from Israel, right? Because they don't like what's happening over there. Now, if we don't respond at all, there's a whole negative protest on all the Ivy League campuses to divest. Now, if we don't respond at all, and most of our kids are really not as sophisticated, most of the Jewish kids on campus are not as sophisticated, and they're not responding, so then there's only one opinion out there, which is anti-Semitic. So you don't want that. So we want to know what they are writing about us on the college campus, the popular literature, all over. Right? Good. So it's A, it's pragmatic, good. B, of equal significance, or perhaps more significance, we have to know how we're doing. Who was the famous mayor who said, how am I doing? Right. How am I doing? It's a very challenging question. I would never ask anybody that question. I'm not going to ask at the end of the day, how am I doing tonight? I'm afraid of the answer. I don't ask that question. Never ask your students how you're doing. That's one of the rules I learned when I once asked my students, how am I doing? Bad move. Just walk out and hope for the best. Run out, maybe, and hope for the best. That's the way you got to work. So, when we read these books, it's a good gauge to what degree we are, in fact, impacting upon the others. Either positively, they're all great, wonderful books about us, or negatively, if we're not doing what we should be doing. And you want to figure out, how do I change if I need to change? Good. What do non-Jews think of Jews when they hear that word? Here's a story that happened. Hillel Yeshiva. We hire non-Jews to teach our history, math, and other courses. A woman comes in. Her name is a very heavily Italian name. And she tells, happens to tell my wife that, you know, I have a real problem over here. I like people who are Jewish, but I can't stand that word to Jew. That's a very, when I grew up in Staten Island, she said this to Emily, to Jew is to cheat, to Jew is to this, to Jew is a very, I can't, I like Jewish people, but Jew is a bad word. How do you use that word, Jew? She's not realizing where she is or what she's doing. Because she has this weird idea. Jewish is good. It's okay. I can deal with that. But the word Jew is, in her vocabulary, in her cultural context, is a very negative word. Because the way she grew up. And she couldn't see this. How does this come together? How could Jewish people be Jews? Or use that word Jew? Because Jew means evil or conniving or cynical or whatever context you were, and yet Jewish people are okay.
Verb and the noun.
Yeah, exactly. The verb and the noun didn't make sense to her. And she sent this to Emily. You know, she sent another secular teacher to her. Amazing. So out there, there are perceptions of who we are. What do they think? What does the average non-Jewish person think when he hears the word Jew or to Jew? We're on Avenue U East 3rd right now, right? This is a whole...
Second.
Maybe it's changed since I was around here 30 years ago. It was in a very nice Italian neighborhood. Is it? What? Should the street?
Gas station.
I remember the gas station. No, it was the gas
station.
It was an Italian neighborhood. Is the average Italian on Avenue U anti-Semitic? What forms his ideas of us? Right. Yeah, be careful. That's right. What does that make him think? What does that mean? It means that if you're Jewish, let's say you're living on Gravesend Neck Road down there. Let's say you want to walk to Ocean Park. It's a Friday night, spring. All the good Italian kids who just finished reading the New Testament, that we were Christ kills and everything else like that, and sons of Satan, right? So now you're wearing a yarmulke, nice big white yarmulke, right? Now, are you going to walk past this 50 kids or not? The answer is, what is their perception of Jews and Judaism? If in fact they really believe that you killed their Lord, you're in trouble. If they take that with a grain of salt and think that only it's a metaphor or that the Pope exonerated us of that, you're in less trouble. Not ahead of trouble, you're in less trouble. These are real questions. If you're Syrian and you know, and they see you as Jewish in Syrian, that's either worse or better, and you're playing basketball on 215, right? How they really relate to you, react to you, is going to depend upon whether they only read the New Testament or maybe they also read, probably not, James Mishnah's 1,000-page book. Because he has a good impression about Jews. Or that might create for them some kind of cultural dissonance. What does that mean? their priest may have told them 30 or 40 years ago that Jews are whatever he said. On the other hand, James Michener says there's something else. Well, how could it be both? Are they good or bad? Are they, do they have honesty when I deal with them in business? Are they honest? Or maybe they're dishonest. My priest says, don't trust that Jew, because the Jew means to cheat. On the other hand, I read these other books, popular literature, which says they're okay, they're good, they're people with a history, with a integrity. So that's what we want to know. What do non-Jews think when they hear the word Jew or see elements of Judaism publicly displayed? Do you ever think of whether or not we put on Hanukkah our menorot? It's all over the place, right? Is that good or bad for us as Jews? You think it's good?
I like to think it's good.
I like to think it's good too. It's good. Does a non-Jew think it's good? Is the non-Jew out there saying, look how powerful they are. I look up, I see, you know, I go to Ocean Park, I see 400 of them. They're all over the place, those Jews. They're multiplying. They're surrounding me. What am I going to do? I'm not voting for Joe Lieben, that's for sure. Is that what he says, the non-Jew? Or say, you know, it's okay to have, we have our Christmas decorations. Yeah, it's very nice. What does the average guy who's going to vote in a voting booth say about those public displays about Judaism? What does he say? What does he say when he sees a movie produced by a Jew? Steven Spielberg is a very prominent producer-director. And he has all these great hits. What, does that tie in? And then he puts out a Schindler's List. What is his message? What is the non-Jew saying about Jews and Judaism when he sees them? Good. These books are, to some degree, an indication of how well we are doing. Not on all levels of society, that's true. But they are reaching a mass audience, and we want to have a very good sense as to what they are thinking. How well are we doing in trying to spread our message across the board?
I'm surprised you didn't mention when we read these books as a way of doing some self-analysis.
Okay.
You just touched on it very briefly. You sort of skirted it.
No, I think it's
to change their opinion, but we should be changing their opinion by looking at what they're saying about.
Yeah, absolutely. That's implied in what I'm saying. That if our message is not getting across, whatever we are has to be changed. Either changing ourselves, or changing the way that we're packaging our goods, or the way we're communicating our message. The gauge has to be what these books are saying about us. Now, of course, I've chosen 5 books that are all positive. Now, I'm going to get to later on why these 5 books. So we'll come back to your point in a few minutes. Yeah? Question? Okay. Good. Now, question? Oh, sorry. I know that book.
But if we're going to read a book about this author that's telling us about us, the way we think about ourselves or the way we think about other people, should we find out whether this author is getting his ideas?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Correct. 100% correct.
Because that will shape the way he looks at us.
Absolutely.
Isn't that important also for us to also understand how they think about us so we could get them to understand them a little bit better?
Okay, that's part of the way we're in impact.
Right.
Correct. Well, that's good. Yeah. Absolutely, 100%. We want to try to figure out why he's saying about us what he's saying about us,
right.
And figure out how to...
From, because
right, absolutely, correct.
Because he lived on Avenue when he was attacked by minivans, the problem. And if he lived in Idaho and he had a guy that he did business with and was the best business deal, so he's going to love Jews or whatever it is.
Yes, amazing point. Think about this. Harry Truman... in 6 minutes proclaimed the State of Israel support, right? And of course we all know that Harry Truman's friend was a guy named Sparner Goldstein, the Goldstein who was in Missouri. Sorry? In Missouri, Goldstein or something. And allegedly Goldstein came to see Harry Truman 2 days before the vote and said, look, the people need it. Yeah, Harry, I know, no. And it worked. Look at that. The state of Israel was proclaimed to the United States and all that because of that one relationship. It's amazing. Yeah.
And Brazil was the second country.
I knew you'd say that.
Recognized Israel 12 minutes after they declared it. And it was Oswaldo Aranha that had a very close friend.
You all know this, right? That Brazil, Geraldo
did it. Aranha.
Right.
Aranha. I have a statue of him
In your house, yeah. Brazil, Amazon? Get that. Now, but that's an important question. Why did Brazil do that?
Because he had a friend.
That's an astounding point. So that one contact, it's a great point, that one contact of how one person thought about another person had worldwide implications, literally. Worldwide implications. So again, how we are doing in terms of getting our message out and impacting upon others is gauged by what they're writing about us on the popular level. And what they're saying, we want to analyze it. Where does it come from? How do we correct it if we have to correct it? Right? That's what we should be doing.
Another question.
Sorry?
But another guy. In the 1600s in Spain, the Jews were very influential in many things in Spain, and also they were very close to
the powers,
to the kings.
Sure.
And through history, we have been very smart to be on that and being one of the methods of
death. It's a very important point, yeah, that we learned to appreciate the value of power, political power, right. From Esther. From Miguel Esther, sorry? From Yosef. Right. From Yosef and all that. Correct. Exactly. How important political power is and how to manipulate, how to use it. Correct. Absolutely correct. Good. Now, pragmatically, you want to know what non-Jews are saying, and also you want to know because we're trying to impact and how well we're doing this. Now, the third reason why we should read these books, related in a manner to the second reason, is rooted in another fundamental principle of Judaism. It's formulated, although I cannot biblically formulate it as easily, but it's formulated as what we'll call Kiddush Hashem. What that means is that we have an obligation of sanctifying God's name. Right? That's how people perceive us, is either a sanctification of God's name or a desecration of God's name. If in fact we are viewed as a people, God-intoxicated people, as Spinoza called us. So if we are so associated with God, then what we do ethically and morally and spiritually is going to impact upon other people as Jews. Kiddush Hashem. Now, these authors, the five that we have chosen, were impressed with Jews and Judaism in some level, in some fashion. We're not even sure with all of them why they felt this way about us, but one would argue that each author spent between 2 and 10 years of his life researching and thinking and talking about Jews and Judaism. In all these cases, it was a positive result. That's called Kiddush Hashem. Somebody did a great job. And look at the ripple effect over here. Ripple effect is that because of James Michener's book, which is a very positive view of what Jews and Judaism is all about, and the others, which we'll get to as well, means that millions of people have been impacted, and millions of people have, now because of that one person who was James Mitchell's friend, maybe his next door neighbor, we don't know, whoever it was, at the end of the day, Kiddush Hashem took place because of James Michener's book, because of that one person. So those people who read those books and feel something positive about us, the result is Kiddush Hashem. This author, through this contact, whatever it was, don't know, has sanctified God's name. And of course, that's one of our goals, to sanctify God's name. Kiddush Hashem. And not, God forbid, the other. The person who cuts off with the yarmulke is called Chilul Hashem. That's desecrating God's name. Blocking his driveway, move your car right now because it's a problem. That's called Chilul Hashem. Whenever somebody walks away with a negative impression as to what Judaism is all about, that's called Chilul Hashem. Good. Now, in the last 100 years, and I haven't done a scientific study of this, but in the last 100 years, very few books came out that were negative about Jews and Judaism. I can't think of one. I have two exceptions. There's two exceptions. But besides the two exceptions, I can't think of any books that came out. Now, in the last 50 years, can you think of, let's say 50 years, from 1960 or 1959, think of any book that was negative about Jews or Judaism? It's amazing.
What do you mean? As different from Zionism? Or
No, it's not really the same thing at all. Well, let me just go further. The two exceptions that I know of course, is the Protocols of Zion. Protocols of Zion came out about 140 years ago, and it was, of course, reproduced by Henry Ford, which is why I say about Fords, F-O-R-D, found on the road dead. Ford, fix or repair daily. Don't buy a Ford. Henry Ford, I got my revenge on him when I bought my Ford. So, Henry Ford, of course, propagated this idea. Protocols of Zion. Jews are trying to take over the world. It came out of Russia in the 1880s, 1870s. He believed it or didn't believe it, anti-Semitic, whatever it was. That is one major exception to this notion. That in the 1920s, around a little bit earlier than that, 1915 actually, he came out with this notion about Jews trying to dominate and take over the world. Protocols of Zion. Sorry? Yeah, the question is how credible is that beyond the immediate confines of Germany? I don't think it was a very impactful book. So I wouldn't really call that. It wasn't really a popular book that's going to impact on broader masses. Protocol Design was extraordinarily popular in America. And of course, as you well know, it's now being reproduced in Egypt, as well as some South American, not Brazil, countries. They don't do that. But in some South American countries, it's being reproduced because there's a strong Nazi influence in some of these countries, as well as in Egypt. You know, that's an amazing statement. That if Egypt is there publishing this book and then the newspaper and so on and all that stuff, then what do you mean you have peace with us? You're creating a whole wave of anti-Semitism. So that's one, Protocol Design, yeah?
There's different kinds of publications, too. I mean, yeah. For example, like, I'm sure Farrakhan's speeches are published wide, you know.
Again, the question is, you know, who's reading it? Who's reading it? How credible is it?
Well, it's very credible. People on the subway, people you walk down the street with, people you work with, people.
Okay, good. That's a matter to be evaluated. When Farrakhan says something, or Muhammad Atta, whatever his second in command was named, are people saying that is what is impacting upon me or not? Now, I have never seen a book that he wrote. I mean, for example, I read Malcolm X, his, you know, autobiography and all that stuff. He wasn't anti-Semitic. Malcolm X, per se. There's not anything there.
Malcolm is really radical.
I'm sorry?
Everybody. I mean, he hates everybody.
Oh, Malcolm?
No, Farrakhan.
Oh, so Malcolm and I were good friends. I liked Malcolm X.
No, Farrakhan.
He was good. Yeah, correct, right. So the question is he impacting, is he really, among the black community, for sure, well, a small segment, I guess, of the black community would be more fair. You know,
if you're not looking upon somebody as virulent as Farrakhan, there are other people who are much more mainstream in terms of people like Sharpton or Jesse Jackson, who everything that they say is not such and such, but whose writings and whose speeches and whose this, you know, and people picking tools and out of context and things like that.
Correct.
And,
oh, that's all certainly true. That has to be monitored.
Widespread.
Correct. Absolutely. That has to be monitored, thought about, discussed. But again, the literature that I'm talking about now, it has a mass audience of millions of people. Bestsellers, right. If you're on the New York, there's a statistic, somebody might know the statistic. If you're on the bestseller list, right? New York Times bestseller list. That means your book has sold X number of millions of copies, whatever it may be. If it's 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. So these books that we have chosen...
And the internet these days in terms of what...
Correct. Oh, that's true. But again, so we're going to have to monitor all that and be aware of all that. But again, these five books are bestsellers. Right? I'm sorry?
Well,
name, please?
Ken Dean. Welcome. American writers in the last 100 years who have written books with characters that are negative characters in Jewish. Hemingway...
Right.
Wasteland.
Shakespeare.
Right.
Edgar
Pound. He was anti-Semitic. I mean, he was sure.
You didn't think that there were any writers in the last 100 years.
No, they wrote popular novels, not novels, popular like that we had written. We write. In other words, a book that's popular, a mass seller like Michener or we're going to do here, that has had such a wide appeal. Haven't we read Edgar Pound? You know, or The Wasteland. Or just, have you read this?
Well, I mean, I think to say that they've had on intellectuals, Wasteland has a greater effect on
intellectuals.
On intellectuals.
Right, so I'm talking about mass audience.
Vicious the source.
Wait, did it say?
In many ways, has a greater effect on American writing and American literature.
Yeah, I'm talking about mass appeal.
Well,
again, how many people have read, you know, the Hemingways? It's you know, how many millions? I want millions of people. So I'm not denying what you're saying. There have been certainly writers who've had negative things or whatever it may be. But even any of these works, maybe except another Pound, one would not say it's an anti-Semitic book about Jews and Judaism. And what we're going to see in these five books, it's exactly, it's a very philo-Semitic, these five books that we're going to talk about. And we're going to see the nuances or subtleties. We're going to analyze all these aspects of the book. So, but even, and even to see a negative Jewish character, is it...
How old was all those books?
Hemingway, 34, 52 years ago. Sorry?
The five books you mentioned, how old?
Oh, we're going to get to it. Don't go, we're going to get to it. Let me just go on. I said, thank you. The other exception is, of course, I mentioned this last class, Arnold Toynbee's book on the history of the world. Arnold Toynbee's book also had negative statements made by Jews. Arnold Toynbee. What? Sorry? It's getting late. I told her I would not be at past 10:30. So I apologize, but I really have to go a little more quickly. And of course, you can point to the listening about his father in World War II. Father Coughlin, ring a bell to anybody? End of the 30s, actually, right? Pre-war. Father?
Father Coughlin.
Right.
1930s.
Very, very virulently anti-Semitic. So that brings back the dinosaur. Yes, there were exceptions where people spoke, this is over the radio.
It was a radio priest.
Right. So who was incredibly anti-Semitic. So you're right, the Farrakhans you have, and you have isolated people that were very, very negative. But in the last 50 years, besides Farrakhan, you know, have I seen anything that was extraordinarily negative about Jews and Judaism? Last 50 years.
CNN.
Sorry?
CNN.
No political comments right now. Ted Turner and I are working out a deal right now, so get back to that. Okay, so good. So those are just popular perceptions that I have, that we haven't seen any anti-Semitic diatribes against Jews and Judaism, which is good. It means that we have done some to some degree, we've been able to kind of wipe away any of those negative stereotypes. And if somebody like that comes out with these statements, God and religion, what happens then? The ADL is so powerful, so strong, it comes out immediately and challenges and questions, and how dare you say things like this. So that's very positive that we're doing something right in terms of those issues. Now, my point over here is that though there are isolated other works, they have not captured the public's eye to the same degree that these bestsellers have in fact captured the public's eye. Now, let's be more specific and more detailed. What we are going to try to do over here is to read, study, and analyze either four or five books, depending upon how it goes the coming weeks, and in one case an article, works that have spanned the last 100 years. We're going to begin with Mark Twain, who has the famous article that Ricky now has, is going to make copies of. Right? You good, Jim? Okay, good. Who wrote this for Harper's Magazine. It's a 20-page article in 1898. Right? We have to analyze it and see... Sorry?
I said, wasn't he in the 19th century when he said 100 years? I made it by 5 years. Okay.
Okay, good. 1898... wrote this extraordinary article about Judaism, and you have to ask the question, why did he write this? Why did Mark Twain, who wrote, you know, the Tom Sawyer and all that, why did he write this work about Jews and Judaism? It's a small article, but why 100 years ago did he write this particular article about Jews and Judaism? And we're then going to go to James Cahill, who in the 1990s wrote The Gift to the Jews. Now, these books came to me over the last 15 years fairly randomly. I happen to have read this book, this article, that book, this book, just in terms of reading, and it struck me how unusual it is that it seems that every decade or so, somebody is so struck by Jews and or Judaism that they want to write a book about it. And these books all happen to have been positive. And in choosing books about Jews, I just happen to read these books. In 1900, you have Mark Twain, and then I skipped, because this is the way it just happened, to James Mitchell Thesaurus in 1960s. In the 70s, Ernest van der Haak, some of you who are dated may remember that, some of you, if you're too young, don't remember that, wrote a book called The Jewish Mystique. And he's a social anthropologist. He's an academician. But the book had a great impact upon many people, because it's entitled, Are Jews Really Smarter Than Non-Jews? And he raised five questions. Are Jews better at sex? The answer is no. Than non-Jews. That was, how do I know? I don't know. He knows the question. I'm not very good at that, so I don't really know. But the question he says is that. I think
that
I'm
was,
not.
That was a challenge.
I think so. That's what I'm leaving soon. Exactly. So in the 70s, when I was in college, Ernst von der Haag, who's not Jewish, a social anthropologist, decided to figure out a book called The Jewish Mystique. So because it had this very catchy title called The Jewish Mystique, and he raised these questions, are Jews really smarter? That caught the public's attention. Because of course, as you well know, we are. Which means is that 12% of Nobel Prize winners are Jewish. And we only represent 0.25% of the world's population. So how is it that really has happened? That has to be analyzed. But that book also is analyzing that information. Then in the 80s, Paul Johnson wrote a book called The History of the Jews. So now, he raised the question, I am a good Christian. He's a well-known journalist, author, historian. He's mainly a journalist. And he writes in the first page over here, he says, why am I a good Christian who has written the history of Christianity? Why am I writing about Jews and Judaism? I was taught by my religion that Jews and Judaism is passé. Jews don't count any longer for anything, nor does Judaism. The New Testament came along, and Christians came along to supplant what the Jews had done. They were good, now we supplanted it, which is, you know, typical Christian thinking on this issue. And he was raised as a good Christian. But I discovered, he says, in his opening page, that in writing about Christianity, I could never hope to understand Christianity so I understood Jews and Judaism. And he writes a 600-page book, huge book, on Jews and Judaism, and his last two chapters on the War of Independence in Israel, 1948, till the present, and on the Holocaust, are some of the finest literature regarding those two topics. A non-Jew wrote this. It's amazing. So in the 80s he wrote this, and then in the 90s, Cahill writes The Gift of the Jews. How a small nomadic tribe affected the way that we all think and feel. That's an amazing statement. The Gift of the Jews is not very catchy, but the subtitle is very catchy. This is why it was a bestseller. Imagine saying, how a small nomadic tribe affects the way we all think and feel. Now, if you're a non-Jew, you want to understand that. You want to know, what do these Jews have? How are they able to affect the way that we all think and feel? So, could I fill in the 1920s and 30s and 40s and 50s books I didn't check? These books I happen to have come across, happen to have read, impressed by them, not because they were such great literature. I didn't happen to like The Gift of the Jews. And there was no... His description of paganism was very good. His description... But I wasn't... It was not chidush. There's nothing great about the book. But it was amazing to me that in the 90s, he wrote this book, as in the 80s, Josh wrote his book, which is a very good book, as in the 70s, Von Dyck wrote his book, and in the 60s, Michener wrote his book. I presume that you could find in the 50s, 40s, 30s, and 20s, books as well about Jews, but I didn't look. Not interestingly. Here's five books, and or four books in one article, all about Jews and Judaism. It's almost like you'd call a random sampling of what was written in the last 50 years, along with Mark Twain's article, which I found just captivating, altogether. So now, more practically, what we're going to do next week is going to read Mark Twain's whole article, and you can get it through Gina, do you want to read it? I'm sorry? You want to read? You should read it beforehand.
Email it.
You can figure that out. Figure however you're going to do it, right?
Email it.
First, she has to find it first.
She has it.
She has it. No, I didn't do that. Or scan it. Scan it.
Find
it.
This is too complicated for me. I can't deal with this. So we want to read that article, and we're going to try to analyze about this author. Why did Mark Twain write such positive things? Is it really all positive? Some of it's extraordinary. Some of it is not so wonderful. Am I comfortable with all that he's written? We want to read it, analyze it, and try to figure out exactly why Mark Twain wrote what he wrote about Jews. We're going to discuss this article for 2 weeks to figure out what people thought of Jews 100 years ago. That's the third and the tenth. Then we're going to have 17th off. Then on the 24th, we're going to start with James, Mishnah Source. If all this continues the way it's going, the way it's planned, which is about a 1,000-page book, 942 pages. So, sorry, start reading now. Right, right. So you have. So try to start it now. And we're going to spend 2 or 3 weeks on that book. Now, you don't have to read it all. You have about 3 weeks to read some of it or most of it, and if you can, read it all. It's a good book, The Source by Mishnah. It's a very good read book. It's sold as much as...
The
No. And then we will take an aspect of it. The primary aspects are, I'm going to take, but I take any aspect, is the last page. Sorry? I'm sure you will find them if they do.
I know you. I don't think Joey reads
Cliff Not even that.
Anybody not signing?
I'm going to focus on the last page and those sections which challenge traditional Orthodox Jewish beliefs. All of this is of interest to me. His perception and where it diverges from what we are taught in school. Sorry? Mishnah, the source. So we'll get more to that next week when we discuss those books. So then we're going to see how all this goes. We'll then go into Vandag the Jewish Mystique and find out if Jews really are smart or not smarter, and if you care if they're better at sex or not. You know. So we'll find out about that as well from the book. And then we'll just see how it goes. Okay, we're going to see if you're still interested, you want to come back, you don't want to come back. I hope that more significantly than what I have to say about it, I think these books will give you a very good sense about what the outside world is thinking about you and how well you are doing in terms of impacting upon those others. Yes?
With all this positive publication, I think that the general consensus out there is that we're terrible. We're bad people. So either these books have no impact whatsoever, or apparently they're not really... changing anything.
I think we have to analyze your sense, your perception, more carefully, which you can't do right now because it's 10:30 and I got a pumpkin story, and I got to wait. So, but we have to come back to that. Yes, thank you. And just figure out, you know, why do you perceive that? And is it your perception? Is everybody's perception? Are they failing in doing that? Maybe. Despite all that they're doing, maybe it is negative.
The fact that they keep writing positive stories
doesn't mean anything, maybe. Okay, that could be.
That they so then we'll have to justify it, you know.
Perhaps. So maybe we have to change our packaging or change what we're doing. We'll do something to get across that message. So we'll see as we go along. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.